Suburban Wastelands. Most of my friends had moved on. Brian had gone to university. Leroy was still out west. Derek was with a new crew. Some had moved downtown for jobs. Others just didn't want me around when I got back from Port Hope. I showed up pleading for help and they literally shut the door in my face. I tripped around for a few months, staying in bus shelters, sleeping in the mall during the day, and staying nights at the top of apartment building staircases. Many times, like a beat-up piece of old driftwood, I washed up on the doorstep of Olive, a church lady who believed in the word of Jesus Christ. Olive was a mother of a friend from high school. She wasn't like the usual hypocrites in church, though. She actually lived it in her daily life. She'd take in youths and make them feel loved, feeding and clothing them, giving them shelter when needed, and she let me in and tried whittling me into something that resembled a human being. I hated listening to her preach, but she did make the Bible something I could understand. I couldn't stay at Olive's all the time, though. I discovered that Brampton had emergency shelters. I tried a men's shelter first. It was a converted old fire hall, a rough place that reeked of old feet and broken dreams. The intake worker told me that I was too young to stay there. "The women's shelter is safer for you," he said. "Here are a few bus tickets. I'll call so they know you're coming." When I got to the Sally Ann, I got my own room, small, private, with a bed, dresser, bathroom, and full access to a kitchen, and a fresh change of clothes. I lay on the bed, listening to the creak of the plastic protecting the mattress sounding sweeter than an angel's voice, and thought, "I'm in heaven here." But things didn't stay heavenly for long. Who's that man making himself a Pop-Tart in the toaster? "I don't feel safe with him here," one lady complained to frontline staff. "He's been kicked out of his home," he said, but she kept on. It was clear I was unwanted, so I left. I begged for money at a strip mall and made my way downtown. I paid the $10 or $15 admission at after-hours raves, clubs, or booze cans, doing drugs and dancing, and ended up sleeping in a corner for a few hours every couple days. New drugs, crystal meth and ketamine, were around, and I started to do and sell both in small batches, gathering enough money to buy food and admission to the next club. They were cheaper than cocaine. I tried to stay away from ketamine, though, because of its sedative effects, the dreaded K-hole that left you defenseless and comatose but awake somehow. The assault was always on the back of my mind. There was an underground club or rave every day of the week in Toronto, always a place to go next. There was a whole community of young castaways like me. I liked being around them. They didn't give a shit that I was half Indian, had darker skin, and didn't have a clue who I was or where I was going, and all of us slowly became hooked on meth. I developed sores all over, my nostrils became red and inflamed, and my waistline shrank and shrank. I spent hours picking away at what I believed were bugs burrowing under my skin. It would escalate the longer I was awake, sometimes up to 124 hours at a time. I'd see worms wriggle on my feet, on my forearms, or near my crotch, and I'd scratch at them until my nails ripped the skin open and pull out my veins. Then I'd repick those scabs, convinced the bugs were still there. My stomach was digesting my intestines. My breath smelled like rotten blood and juicy trash boiled in acid, and it hurt to swallow. The state of things terrified me, and I took off back to Brampton. I stayed with a buddy for a month, but he had the same problems I had, so I moved on and knocked on Jerry's door. He had an apartment of his own he rented with one of his friends. "I don't even recognize you," he said when he answered. "What happened?" "I just can't stop," I said. I recall him grabbing me and barricading me in his room. I shivered and sweated and thought I was going crazy as the drugs left my system. Every time I tried to leave, he tackled me and restrained me and stuck me back in the room and rebolted the door. Sometimes the door would crack open and a sub sandwich would fly into the middle of the room and land by my feet. I'd eat it and then pass out and have the worst nightmares. Zombies eating themselves, the farm boys smashing my skull in, Clive's head exploding in his blue house, Yorkie running backwards up the wall like he was possessed by demons. As I emerged from my chemical haze, there were days when I sat with my ear glued to the wall while Jerry battled his friends in the living room, negotiating a spot for me to stay on the couch after I'd sobered up. No one was keen on letting me live there. When I could, I collected my things in a garbage bag and left. Family wedding. "Keep six," I whispered to my little brother Daniel, who stood near the mirror in the Value Village clothing store in Vancouver. I ducked down and pivoted, blocking the line of sight to the cashier. I grabbed a sports blazer, a pair of black slacks, a white button-up shirt, a belt, a pair of dress shoes, and a skinny black tie and stuffed them in my plastic grocery bag. "She's coming, she's coming," Daniel said, a note of panic in his voice. I glanced in the mirror and saw a lady in a red employee's smock. She'd been pricing men's shoes two aisles over. I threw the bag under the rack and stood up to greet her. She yanked the bag out, opened it, and threatened to call the police. Daniel and I backpedaled and then ran out the front door and down the street. She'd fallen for the ruse. I'd gone in behind Daniel and changed into a suit, tie, and shoes before anyone noticed, then told Daniel to keep an eye out. He had amateur written all over his face. He gawked around like he was doing something wrong, pacing back and forth, while I stuffed the decoy bag full of things, which caught the attention of the store employee who focused on the bag instead of on the suit I was wearing. It was an old trick that I'd learned. "How did you learn to steal like that?" Daniel asked. "That was nothing." To me, it was just another day at the office. I picked a butt off the ground and lit it. The truth was I didn't know. It just came naturally, kind of like breathing. It was the first time I'd seen my little brother since he and Mom had disappeared with George years before. When Josh phoned Jerry and invited me to a September wedding, he said we'd put aside our differences and be cordial on his big day, and that he'd pay for my flight out west if I could just get it together long enough to look human. He said it'd be the first time all us brothers would be together again, that it was important I be there. I jumped at the chance to see my baby brother, and to witness Josh and his fiancée Margaret get married. I was lucky to have caught the call. I circled back to Jerry's just to check in or crash periodically, but I was glad that I did. I wouldn't have missed the wedding for the world. The suit I just nicked was too tight. I bent over and polished my shoes with some spit. They, too, weren't my size. But it would all have to do. Daniel picked a ball of lint off my blazer and brushed my shoulder. He had features so much like me, but he was better and healthier looking. We'd met up earlier that day at the church and got along right away. Mom was there, too, and we kissed and all that good stuff, like reunited, long-lost mother and son, which is what we were. Then I'd pulled Daniel aside. "Dude, I can't go dress like this," I pointed at my clothes. They weren't that bad, street garb, just not dressy enough for my brother's wedding. I informed him that I needed a wingman. Daniel said he'd helped right away. I think he wanted to hang out with me. My reputation preceded me, I guessed. "What happened to you?" I asked him as we headed back to the chapel, fearful that the ass crack in my pants might split wide open. "You and Mom just kind of fell off the map." "We had to run away." I could hear the tension in his voice as we crossed the street and picked up the pace. "There'd be spit flying everywhere," Daniel said about George's fits of rage. "One day Mom had enough. She pulled me from school and we went to Saskatoon. We left so fast. Mom only had one shoe and I didn't have a coat. I'm sorry we didn't call." "It's okay, Daniel. I've been messed up. I wouldn't have had much to say." I sat outside the reception hall for a lot of the night, smoking. The place was crowded with out-of-uniform RCMP officers, Josh's colleagues, and their presence made me jumpy. Grandpa was there too, and he gave me cut-eye so bad I was sure he was casting a malevolent spell on me. When I tried to speak to him during the photo shoot, he walked away. Jerry told me I was only attending because Josh had gone to bat for me. I bumped into Grandma on the way to the washroom, though, and she said, "You look good," pinching my cheek and slipping a $100 bill in my pocket. "Now smarten up." It was the only contact we had. Mom's family was there as well, my aunts and about 7 cousins my age from Saskatchewan. They sat in a section off to the side by themselves, but were super friendly, mingling, laughing, drinking, and carrying on. They were the best dancers in the joint, but I didn't really interact with them. Jerry stuck by my side, going inside to dance when a song he liked came on, and we shared bottle after bottle until the world spun around us. Mom came out to join us about halfway through the festivities. "Look at you," she said to me, a cigarette in one hand, a glass of red wine in the other. She swayed a little and sat between me and Jerry. Jerry pulled back. "I hear you're a little troublemaker, eh?" She smiled. She was half in the bag, but still very much alert. I wondered if it was her way of mustering up the courage to talk to us. "That's okay," she said. "I still love you no matter what." She hugged me close and the awkwardness fled. It'd been years since we had embraced. "Here," my Aunt Cecile said, "a whore's breakfast." She thrust an empty plate with 2 aspirins on it at me, and then handed me an open beer. I swallowed the pills and took a few chugs to wash them down. I handed back the empty bottle, and she winked and clicked her teeth. A few minutes later, the pounding in my head stopped. My hangover was gone. The smell of eggs and bacon was strong in the kitchen. We'd spent the night after the wedding at my auntie's place. She shuffled around the stove with a cigarette hanging out of her mouth as my other relatives squirmed about, still trying to sleep out on the dining room floor. Their names escaped me, but they all looked familiar. One guy looked like Josh, but was slimmer. I recognized my Auntie Vaughn, who sat on the couch reading a magazine. "Chi garçon, mon bébé," she said to me, and then a bunch of stuff that sounded French, but not quite. "He doesn't have a clue, Padour," Aunt Cecile said. "He's been gone for 20 ans." "Mon Dieu," Aunt Yvonne bellowed. "You can't speak Michif anymore?" "Michif," I thought. What's that? Aunt Cecile said something as my mom came out of the bedroom. She had a big smile on her face like she'd already consumed Aunt Cecile's special breakfast. She said something back and my auntie started laughing. I spoke Michif?" I asked. "God, yes," Mom chuckled. "You didn't say a word until you were 3, but then we couldn't shut you up." Aunt Cecile howled in the kitchen and my mom started to laugh, so hard I thought she might pee herself. One of my cousins sat up and said, "Yeah, and you covered everything in shit when you got upset, dirty little bugger." Her accent was thicker than Annie Vaughn's. "Lishy cock, gross." Again, the room busted up. "Never mind them," Mom said. "You were a clean boy. My boy." "We're just playing," Auntie Vaughn brayed. "It's good to see you." She got up and squeezed me, and her arms were like powerful bear arms. I hugged back, but she was way stronger than me. Aunt Cecile put a plate of eggs on the counter. "This is mine. All you chien have to fend for yourself." She laughed and started eating. "But there's tea made," she motioned to the kitchen table, where a teapot squatted on a lace doily. I sat down and poured myself a cup, and Mom pulled up the chair next to me. It was hard to make eye contact without alcohol coursing through my veins. She was a complete stranger. Her sisters were hovering around like bees pollinating flowers. "I know you've been all over," she said. She twiddled her thumbs and drew in a deep breath. There was a jar of jam beside the teapot. Saskatoon's, it read. I focused on that. I thought of Cook'em Nancy and her Coke bottle glasses and her walking stick. How would you like to come home with me? Annie Vaughn moved behind me and placed her hands on my shoulders. Mom, it's been years. I could hear the tick of the clock and Aunt Cecile's breathing. She sounded like she was having a heart attack. It wouldn't have to be forever, Jesse. Auntie Vaughn jumped in. Just try it out. Saskatoon is a wonderful little city. I don't think so. I live in Toronto. All my friends are there. Jerry, too. Aunt Cecile swung open the back door and I heard something smash. There's work and lots of Métis girls for a handsome young man like yourself, Auntie Vaughn said, this time in my ear. But my home is Toronto. I felt like I had to defend my point. I'm sorry. It was like they'd been waiting for me to wake me up, just to ask me this question. Did Josh and Jerry set this up to get rid of me? I started getting angry. I was certain my brothers were behind this. Mom stood up, called Daniel, grabbed her keys, and marched downstairs. She and Daniel loaded up her car. Daniel asked me to reconsider, and I could tell he was trying to defuse the tension. She was hurt. I think she really expected me to accept. Crack. Four of us were huddled around the coffee table in my buddy's Brampton apartment. We poked holes in our pop cans near the base, the thumbtacks moaning as they bit through the aluminum. The resulting circle of about 20 holes was around the size of a dime. I had mine done in seconds. The ash goes on there. My buddy flicked a cigarette so ash covered the holes and flattened the burnt carbon with his thumb, and then waited for us to do the same. Then he pulled a little white rock from his sock and took the plastic wrap off it. I've got a chicken here, 7 grams. He held up the walnut-sized piece of drywall-looking drug. Costs a lot, but I'm serving you all free. Just remember to come to me afterwards. Enjoy, boys. He broke the piece into quarters and handed one to each of us. Just watch what I do. He snapped a little fragment off his quarter and placed it on his can, in the center of the ashes. His fingers shook a little like he was holding a precious jewel. We followed his lead. I put a particularly large piece on my can. Ready. He flicked his lighter and held the open flame over his crack toke, and it melted into the ash. It sizzled a bit, like a tiny skillet cooking bacon. He put his mouth to the opening of his pop can and sucked in, gently pulling the flame down. The wet spot where the melted rock was sizzled louder, then collapsed in upon itself. He held in the smoke for a minute and then exhaled. It smelt like burnt cotton candy mixed with fried plastic, sweet but chemical. His chin started wagging and a line of drool rolled over his lip onto the carpet. He tried to speak, but a moan came out. The rest of us lit up. When I released my lungful of crack like a dragon blasting a plume of fire on some medieval castle, the most intense feeling vibrated my brain. I could hear the loudest ringing I've ever heard, like a locomotive train rushing by an inch from my ear. I placed my can down and the void within was filled to overflowing. I felt like a god, superhuman. Like 100,000 Roman candles were going off in my soul. When that initial high dissipated, I did it again, and again, and again, until my little quarter section was gone. Then I got down on all fours to search the carpet for any remnants that might have fallen. My buddies did the same. We kept searching. I was hooked. Canadian streets greasy with indigenous fat. The secret history tells us, once a blue wolf arose from the soil. He took as his mate a fallow deer. There, at the head of the sea, a son was born. Descendants of that son traveled light upon the grasslands, using speed and surprise. They learn to own nothing, to adapt to all conditions, and burning dry dung for warmth. From out of the eastern sunrise, these homeless nomads rode. On horseback they came, setting everything ablaze. They littered the stolen streets with their bodies and left them greasy with their own fat. Caught up. It was the turn of the millennium, but the day after Y2K was odd. No crash, no power outages, no blood or violence in the streets, no Armageddon. The only thing that seemed out of place was the red University of Nevada, Las Vegas, UNLV, basketball jersey I was wearing. It was new, with the university teams fighting Southern rebel mascot in the middle. I didn't have much these days. I was with Uncle Ron drinking beer at his apartment. He'd moved back in with Jerry after his daughter had graduated high school and had moved back to the city herself. I begged him and Jerry for a place to stay after most of my stuff had been stolen from a local shelter, and was lucky that they agreed. Ron and I were watching The Saint, starring Val Kilmer. Random farts from Solomon perfumed the stale air, reminding me that I shouldn't have fed him wet food. I spent the previous night, New Year's Eve, at a friend's party. We drank ourselves into oblivion, singing and wearing those stupid Y2K glasses. As the clock edged close to midnight, we congregated in the hot tub and blazed a series of fat joints, then waited for the subsequent hellfire to rip apart our lives. The girl next to me pulled down her bikini top and showed me her breasts. Their fleshy presence complemented the celebratory cheers and horns that resounded throughout the house. I grabbed her and gave her a sloppy kiss to welcome in the new millennium. I think she appreciated the distraction because her tongue darted around in my mouth. There was no magic between us. We were just two young people trying to forget about the impending calamity. The emotionless kiss was just an available tool of diversion. After we unhinged our faces, I grabbed my bag of blow and cut two shoelace-sized lines on the edge of the tub. Drugs helped me forget everything I didn't want to think about. It made me feel good about myself. I snorted mine first. She followed and then rubbed the leftover residue across her gums with her finger and brayed like a horse. The coke kept us up for another few hours, but there was no sex, even though we did try in the bedroom upstairs. I just couldn't get it up. Hard liquor and blow had that effect on me. Then the music faded, conversations died out, people bid their farewells, and it was time to go. I thought of her tits as I stumbled home and was mad at myself for not being a man, for not capitalizing. When I reached Uncle Ron's, I was still wired. I leered at myself in the bathroom mirror, and my eyes looked like two piss holes in the snow. Sleep is impossible tonight, I concluded. I decided to go farther down the road to see if anyone was still up over at Olive's, the church lady, where, unknown to her, our crew had our headquarters. When I got there, Olive's son Frank was up watching TV. He told me that the new hangabouts, Stefan and Mike, two neighborhood street kids who had no real home like me, had left a few hours before to go out on a mission. What kind of mission? Deliver drugs, shoplift at the drugstore, sell shit, what? I don't know, Frank shrugged. I could tell he wanted me to leave. I couldn't blame the kid. His house had a revolving door. Olive's Christian mission sometimes left her family crowded in their own home and often without food. Frank, who was just 16, had done more mission work, I figured, than many pastors had done over decades in Africa. He was the same as his mom, kind, giving, and open to a fault, even if he wasn't religious. He never raised his voice around any of us, and we'd become good friends. Do they have dope? I asked, as I slipped my shoes back on. Nah, they smoked it all before they left. Frank got up. You don't have to go, he grumbled as he shuffled past me to the washroom. We got PB&J and bread in the cupboard, and you're welcome to it if you want. If Jesus was like anyone, I believed he was like Frank, but without the mohawk hairdo, facial piercings, and torn to shreds punk attire. But the thought of a sweet sandwich made my stomach turn, the liquor and coke sloshing around all toxic. "Where's Tim?" I asked. He was Frank's older brother. He was 18, looked like Alice Cooper when Cooper was young and scary, black eyeliner, black clothing, black hair shaved up the sides. And he was the opposite of his younger sibling. The constant cavalcade of homeless people in the house had hardened him, made him into what can only be described as a pure metal hellspawn who slaughtered daily goodwill by blasting Marilyn Manson and Slipknot over top of the sound of the church organ Olive had in the living room. I'm sure that eerie mix of gospel hymns and hardcore thrash traumatized me, but Tim's reaction to all the commotion and Christian indoctrination was strange considering that most of the transient guests were his friends, teenage goth misfits from group homes and juvenile detention centers who had been disowned by their families or had fled domestic abuse situations. It left me wondering if it was all some big act Tim put on as a defense against the biblical-level chaos going on around him. "He's not here," Frank said. The sound of piss echoed in the toilet bowl. "He's been gone for a couple of days." I heard the toilet flush. Then he returned to his chair to flip through the channels. I left and went back up the road to Uncle Ron's to catch some sleep. I awoke around 9 a.m. to Solomon licking my face. I was on my makeshift bed in the middle of the sunroom, and that was his sign he needed a walk. I could hear Uncle Ron and Jerry groaning in their rooms, and a $10 bill magically appeared from under my brother's door. "Take him out, Jess," Jerry said, his voice as raspy as a desert toad. "My fucking head's pounding." The place was filled with vodka bottles and ashtrays overflowing with joint roaches. Zigzag rolling papers were strewn across the sofa, looking like a trail leading up to a mountain of cigarette butts cascading over the edge of the coffee table. "Must have been one hell of a scorcher," I chuckled to myself as I snatched up the money and took the dog out for his shit. Armed with a little cash for dope, I returned Solomon to the apartment and again made my way down to Olive's. It was 11 a.m. and Mike and Stefan were in the middle of the kitchen throwing dice. Mike dressed like a flashy Puff Daddy crossed with Eminem. He looked Scottish or something, but it was hard to tell. Stefan easily pegged as Italian, olive skin and a Roman nose, and he talked with his hands and said things like "forget about it" and "manja cake." He was much harder around the edges than anyone in our hood. He dressed like a professional weed dealer, and his hair was tied up in a ponytail and was covered in a do-rag, and he had a Yankees hat perched perfectly atop his head. He'd once told me that he'd come to Canada from the United States after he'd gotten into some serious trouble down there. He towered over me and Mike and anyone else at Olive's. Their friend Stan, a black kid, was behind the circle of dice players holding the day's winnings. He was born with a club foot and had a severe limp and some cognitive challenges, and it was his job to dish out the round's payout to whoever threw sevens or elevens. Stan was trustworthy and always treated everyone with whatever he had. Dope, food, booze, which was rare around us younger street people. I liked Stan, even if I didn't understand what he said half the time. His stutter was so bad. There were a few other kids I didn't know rifling through the fridge.
Yo, yes,
Stan stuttered.
You want to play?
I can't. I only have $10, I said. And I want to smoke a doob. I yanked out my loan bill and dangled it midair, hoping someone would step up and break open their weed sack and let me have a gram. Stan smiled.
I'm all up, buddy.
Stefan reached into his pocket and hauled out a lean fold of bills.
I'm all, buddy.
He curled his arm and held it like a little T-Rex arm, then contorted his face. The room exploded in laughter. Stan froze and stuttered, but no words came out. They all sounded like a wild pack of hyenas, and I wanted to fucking punch Stefan in the head. Stefan peeled back the layers of his billfold, counting out his cash like he was Tony Montana in Scarface. He only had $100, but to us, it was like having a fortune, and he knew it.
We had a good night, he said. He grinned and punched Mike's shoulder. Yeah, good night. Mike's voice petered out, and he gazed a 1,000-mile stare down at the linoleum floor. Olive's music started up in the next room, so I knew she hadn't gone to church. The sound of her singing psalms cut through the tension. I expected Tim's music to soon drown her out, but he still wasn't home, apparently. I saw Frank get up from the sofa to go to his bedroom, and he waved to me on his way. Number one rule, Stefan went on, raising his voice above Olive's melodic petition of David, don't rat. The room fell silent. What Stefan said was true. We were bound by a code, the code of silence. You only talked about what you did with those you did it with. It was better to not know than to know and have a secret that could eventually find its way out. That was our only protection. Stefan repeated the sentiment slowly, this time running his thumb across his throat. I'd seen lots of guys warn dudes to keep their mouths shut before, but the way Stan cowered made my skin crawl. One of the kids near the fridge stepped forward to put a glass on the table and fill it with juice. He took a swig and then said, I got a gram, and flicked a little green baggie my way. It bounced and landed square in front of me. He either didn't care about Stefan and his warning or was too daft to listen. Thanks. I opened it, rolled up a pregnant spliff, and invited the room out. Only Stefan, Mike, and Stan accepted, and we went out to our spot at the side of the building. Stan trailed behind me. Mike and Stefan shifted from corner to corner, staying in the shadows. I don't want to be out here too long, Mike said, ducking behind the cement wall, blocking the view of the building next to us. Stefan joined him and kept his eyes on the pathway near the road. Stan and I held our ground out in the open as we blazed up the joint and each took a toke. Sirens in the distance moaned and whined, a familiar sound in the hood. They were much too far away to catch us, but I kept my eyes peeled regardless. Stan took another drag, then passed it off to Stefan. He, then Mike, took a short, almost non-drag, then passed it back to me. That's boy them, Stan said, his eyes trained on mine. Lots of squad cars around here last night. They even had the ghetto bird in the air. He made the noise of a helicopter and pretended to duck low. He nudged my arm. Careful, Jess. Mike and Stefan fell dead silent watching Stan, then cackled, only softer, more sinister than in the kitchen. Stan whispered again, so only I could hear. Be careful. Mike stopped laughing. Yo, blood! I see you got some bunk clothes, homeless motherfucker. You like my jersey? He pointed down to his UNLV shirt, pulling at the bottom to make the team's logo more visible. It was this season's. I couldn't afford something that nice. Yeah, dog, it's fresh, I said. I wish I was dipped out like that, but I'm just... You can have it, Stefan interrupted, if you can help us out. His offer hung in the air as I took another drag. Sure, I said, releasing the smoke. What do you want? Stan started shaking his head, his lips pursed shut. Mike walked in front of him. Two things, Stefan continued. We're trying to go out west tonight and know you have connections. Can you link us with a place to go? Maybe even a ride? I took another puff. Seemed reasonable. Ride, place to stay, no problem. And we hungry as fuck, Stefan said, rubbing his belly and smiling. Can you do us a solid and order us a pizza? I ain't no good at it and don't like talking on the phone neither. Plus, we'll give you a whole pizza on your own for doing it. Order you a pizza? What the fuck is wrong with you? I laughed and coughed on smoke, the pressure burning my throat and chest. I noticed Stan was gone. He must have slipped in through the side door. Didn't even stay to finish the blunt. Okay, give me the jersey right now and I'll do it. As long as I didn't have to do anything sexual or pay out money to get clothed and fed, I was game to do whatever they were asking. Mike pulled the jersey off and gave it to me, and I slipped it on. One more thing, Stefan said. Just ask for the ride. Don't say who it's for. Whatever, I said as I admired my new dips. It fit snug around my waist and looked crisp as it hung over my frame. When we got indoors, I got on the phone with my buddy Sean, a friend I'd hitchhiked and gone to high school with. Sean said he could hook up a place to stay in Calgary, but that the ride would be harder to find. I knew he was puzzled by my request. I knew how to travel long distance. I knew how to hitchhike, and I already knew people to stay with in Calgary any time. Before I got off the phone, I made a mistake. I let it slip that the ride wasn't for me, but I wasn't clear who it was for. That makes a little more sense, Sean said as he hung up. I was wondering if you banged your head somewhere. Next, I ordered 3 large pizzas and tailored my very own just the way I like. Ground beef, pepperoni, and extra cheese. Fucking beautiful. When the pizza dude arrived, Stefan and Mike told me to tip him extra. I gave him a 20. Thanks, buddy, he said. Best tip all night. I went home to Uncle Ron's thinking it was the simplest work I'd ever done. I was grateful to my new friends that I'd started the new millennium in such a positive way. The Saint's a remake, you know, Uncle Ron said as the credits rolled on at the end. I like the original better. He flicked his thumb in his beer and it made a blooping noise, like a stone dropped down a well. Solomon cut another fart. Jesus, Uncle Ron said, I'm suffocating over here. The dog lifted his head as if he knew we were talking about him. Just then, the 11 p.m. news flash came across the TV. A cab driver had been murdered New Year's Eve near Gateway 6 movie theater in Brampton. The reporter went on to say that police were looking for 2 suspects, a tall man with black hair and a ponytail and a shorter man with blonde hair, both in their late teens or early 20s. If anyone has any information, they are encouraged to contact Peel Police, the reporter said. A picture of the murdered cabbie flashed across the screen, and Uncle Ron went to change the channel. No, I said, knocking the remote out of his hand. I stared at the name of the cabbie, Baljinder Singh Ray, 48, father of 2. It was Toronto's first murder of 2000. I swear I heard a helicopter and Stan stammering. Stan lowering his head in silence while Stefan pulled out his roll of bills like a big shot. Everyone in the kitchen laughing. How Stefan and Mike had moved to avoid unwanted attention, watching their angles and lines of sight. Like we all did when we shoplifted or ran from the police. Careful, Chiquette, Stan had said. I stood up, my legs trembled underneath me, and I fell backward onto Uncle Ron. What the fuck? He said. The room started spinning and I ran to the bathroom to throw up, but I missed the toilet bowl and it hit the sides of the sink and tub and got vomit on the front of my shirt. Uncle Ron ran in. Jesse, what's wrong? I wiped my mouth with my shirt, then realized it was the jersey. My nice new gift from my nice new friend Mike. I fell back onto my ass, up against the towel rack. The shirt, the pizza, the ride out west, the mission from the night before, I fell for everything. I was caught up in something huge. I didn't even have an alibi for the time of the murder on New Year's Eve. I was with that drunk chick doing blow, trying to score. I'd made all the phone calls, gave the pizza guy the cash, talked with the pizza place and given my name, and had the shirt Mike was likely wearing when the crime was committed. I vomited again. The black pubic hair I could see on the bowl's edge seemed immense. The smell of urine dominated my nostrils, nauseating me further. My uncle's breathing behind me sounded like the bellows in a blacksmith's forge. He was scared, I could tell. And the sound of my own blood coursing through my ears thundered louder than a jet engine. I sat down on the tub, clutching the edge. I ripped off the jersey and threw it onto the floor. I wanted to take a shower all of a sudden, but knew nothing could wash off the filth of what they'd done or the trouble I was in. Uncle Ron looked at the shirt. What? He had no clue. They did it, I shouted. They fucking killed that taxi driver and gave me this shirt. A stream of tears rolled down my cheeks, but I wasn't crying. It was a mix of fear and rage and confusion. I was under a giant's thumb and it was pressing me further and further through the bathroom floor into hell, crushing every bone in my body.
"Don't you say a word," Uncle Ron said, bending down to me. "Just shut the fuck up. You don't want trouble. If you're saying what I think you're saying."
I backed up against the shower wall, shocked.
"You don't understand," I said. "I'm involved. I can't shut up."
He shook his head and scrunched up his face like he did when someone fucked around with his money. He was like me, a street person. We weren't supposed to talk. Not now, not ever, no matter the circumstances or trouble. He was someone who'd done time, was solid, would solve problems at the drop of a hat. He grabbed my arm and hauled me to my feet.
"Snap out of it," he shouted. "You've got to think."
His lunchbox hands squeezed my shoulders. "I love you, Jesse. I'm trying to protect you. Burn the shirt." He picked it up and handed it to me. I stared at it, wishing the nightmare would end. He closed my fist around the shirt, holding my hand in his. "Your life is on the line." I knew what that meant. I ran out of the apartment and down to the dumpster out back and started gathering paper and sticks. I laid the jersey on my collection of kindling and sprayed the wood pile with the lighter accelerant Jerry kept in the apartment for a Zippo. But just before I struck a match, a sobering thought came to me. I knew Frank had seen me the night before. Twice, in fact. I stopped at Olive's at 9 p.m. just before I went to the Y2K party, and again at around 3 a.m. when it was over, and he'd told me that Mike and Stefan had gone out. He was also there today, right before I got the jersey from Mike, so he would have seen Mike with it on earlier, and then me leaving with it on later after I'd eaten the pizza. I put my match back in my pocket, rescued the jersey from its funeral pyre, and hightailed it to Olive's. When I got there, I peered through the sliding glass doors. It was dark. I banged on the window a few times, but no one answered. Olive's two cats pawed at the glass.
"Frank!"
I yelled into the night sky, then at the cats, hoping to conjure them up from thin air. The crickets stopped chirping, though, and a neighbor told me to shut the fuck up. I slumped against the doors, shirt in hand. I considered burning it again. Then a light came on in the kitchen, and I saw a hooded figure shuffling around inside. It was Frank, making himself a peanut butter sandwich. I banged on the glass even harder and held the jersey up against it, catching his attention. He made his way to the doors and opened them, wiping crust out of his eyes.
"Dude, fuck, I'm sleeping. Calm your shit," he squinted.
"Do you need to crash or something? Come in, but shut the fuck up." "No, no, it's more serious," I blurted. "It's about this jersey and Mike and Stefan and the pizza end."
"Whoa,
slow down. I'm barely awake," he said, and rammed a slice of PB&J into his mouth.
"See this?"
I shoved the jersey in front of his face. "That's Mike's. I made a few calls and ordered food, and they gave it to me for doing them a favor, remember?"
"Yeah, so?"
"You saw him with this on yesterday and earlier today, right?"
"Yeah, why?"
"They did something terrible," I said and glanced around, scared someone else might hear. "They tried to frame me by giving it to me and making me make phone calls out west and pizza, and I need you to be my witness."
Frank's eyes widened.
"The shirt is his, not mine. I'm going to call the cops and explain it all." I put the shirt in Frank's hands and asked him to leave it on the couch or give it back to Mike when he saw him. I could tell he was having a hard time understanding what I was doing, why I'd rat them out.
"Listen," I said, "they killed someone. I don't believe in hurting people like that. Selling dope and stealing is one thing, but murdering is another."
Frank shook his head, threw the jersey on the sofa, and shut the glass doors. He'd never done that before. Closed the door in my face. I wasn't sure he'd help me.
Rat. "I'd like to report a murder," I said. "The cabbie from yesterday, Baljinder Singh Ray." The line was silent. Then I heard a click and the 911 operator say, "Murder, where? Be specific."
"Brampton, New Year's Eve, Gateway 6, I said and rubbed the sweat off my free hand onto the arm of the couch.
I tried lighting a cigarette, but my thumb shook so violently I couldn't strike the wheel to create a spark. I flicked it a few more times. Nothing. "Okay, sir, where are you?" Her voice sounded firmer, more focused. I told her the address. I was still at Uncle Ron's place. "What's your name?" "Me? I'm Jesse Thistle. Two guys I know did it, Stefan and Mike. I don't know their last names." She told me to stay on the line. 10 seconds passed, maybe, and I looked around for Uncle Ron. He must have locked himself in his room, I thought. He doesn't want to see me become Judas. I again tried to light my cigarette, but again, I failed. The 911 operator came back on the line. "I've dispatched officers to your location. Do not leave." I heard a chorus of radio chatter in the background, a barrage of police lingo I didn't understand. Before I knew it, someone was pounding on the door. If it was the police, I had no idea how they'd bypass lobby security. It literally taken them 1 minute to come. I was still on the phone. I hung up and peered through the people and saw two huge men in uniform, although they must have left their jackets in the squad car. Early 20s, their hands hovering over their firearms. My stomach dropped. They weren't fucking around. This is it. Go time. I panicked a bit and scanned the apartment for an exit. Over near Solomon's bed, then over to Jerry's door, then the sunroom, and considered jumping out the window 2 stories to the ground below. Running away was my way of dealing with life, my solution when things got hairy, and it was something ingrained in me since my days with Dad and traveling with my old Adidas bag. And it always seemed to work. But there was nowhere on earth I could run to avoid this mega-sized clusterfuck. "Mr. Thistle, Jesse," a voice thundered. "We know you're in there. We just got a call from dispatch." He hammered on the door so it shook in its frame, and I swear loosened a few marbles in my skull. His radio was going berserk, but I could make out that more officers were en route. I heard sirens screaming outside. They were getting closer and sounded like they were coming from every direction. The idea of a swarm of cops frightened me, but running was now impossible. I opened the door as Uncle Ron came out of his room. His hands were clenched. One police officer's arms were the size of cement pillars, all veiny and tanned. The left was covered in tribal tattoos. His bulging muscles looked constricted by his tiny blue shirt. His partner was shorter, more refined, with a uniform that actually fit his torso. The second guy did all the talking. "Jesse, we've come to escort you to 21 Division. We need your statement." The elevator doors in the hallway opened and more police appeared. "Let me get my jacket and shoes," I said, my head spinning. "No problem. Take your time." Uncle Ron came up behind me, slipped a pack of smokes in my pocket, and told me to be strong. I can't remember if he said anything to the officers before they ushered me out of the building, but I thought of him the whole ride to the station. I was surprised at how nice the officers were. They cracked jokes about their jobs and some of the stuff they'd seen earlier that day. They even asked if I was hungry or needed anything before we reached the station. I blurted out, "Not hungry, but this is like being in a real-life episode of Law and Order, eh?" I saw the big guy nudge his partner. He was too stupid to play games and too stupid to pretend he was my friend. When we arrived and got out of the car, but before we entered the station, they cuffed me, saying it was for my own safety and for the safety of the officers inside. The cuffs bit into my wrists as the bigger officer hoisted my arms behind my back, pushed me forward, parading me past clerical officers toiling at their desks. They acknowledged Mr. Muscles, but none made eye contact with me. It was as if I was a criminal, or some trophy prize they'd dragged home to Mama. The interrogation room had one table with 2 chairs facing each other. There was a video camera in the corner, and on the desk were 2 coffees, an empty ashtray, and a pad of paper and a pen. "Tell us everything you know," the smart officer said. He lit a smoke and pushed the coffee my way. "Don't be afraid." He motioned to his buddy, who unlocked the cuffs, then left us alone. I took a sip of coffee and the red light on the camera went on. I told him everything, About the jersey, the pizza, the Y2K party, the drunk girl, the call to Sean, Frank as my witness to it all, everything. He jotted down things and let me speak freely. At times I felt like he wasn't paying attention. Every so often, he'd offer me a new coffee, and the big guy would come in and take away the old cup and give me a new one. They did the same thing with the cigarette butts after I'd smoked, always returning with a fresh new ashtray and lone cigarette. "I think we have some evidence," the officer said after a couple of hours, as he nodded to the camera, "but not enough to charge anyone." The big officer came back in the room with his own chair and sat beside his partner on the other side of the table. "Did you see any weapons on Mike or Stefan?" the smart one asked. The steel of the chair was cold against my back as I shifted for comfort. Then it came to me. "I don't know. But Stefan has a big knife. It's about 9 inches long with a pearl handle. Serious knife." The two officers turned to face one another. "Draw it," the big guy said, and tore notes off the pad of paper, leaving a blank page exposed. "As much as you can." The smart officer bit the nail of his index finger and started shaking his left knee up and down. I glanced and saw the light on the camera was still on. The lens made me feel like a tiny ant getting roasted under a giant magnifying glass in the sun. I wiped away the sweat, drenching my brow, and sketched out the knife. A long, sharp blade with a well-formed grip and hilt. The picture was crappy, but it conveyed the vital data. "How do you know he had this knife?" the smart officer asked. His intense stare told me that this was the most important piece of information I had to offer. The hum of the neon light above us sounded like a cloud of road allowance black flies. "Because I taught him how to scam welfare 3 weeks ago." They looked at each other, puzzled. Stefan's homeless and Olive was sick of having him around the house eating all the food. So I felt sorry for him and told him to go to the shelter to see the emergency social service worker who cuts checks. "All you need is a rental letter and a phone number." Both officers leaned in, and I could tell they were having a hard time following. "They give out $1,000 for startup if you have that. It's to get you set up in a place with food and clothes, all that shit. But most people just scam it for money and stay at a friend's house. I do it all the time. Forge rental documents so I have money." "What does that have to do with the knife?" the smart guy interrupted. He pushed the drawing into the center of the table, then flicked his butt, blowing smoke up toward the light, where it swirled around the bulb, then was sucked up through the ceiling vent. "When Stefan scammed welfare, he bought a knife and some white baseball gloves. I thought it was a waste of money, but hey, that's what he did. I hear he and Mike are back living at the shelter now. They just go to Olive's during the day." The officer sat back and a third, much older, officer came in and said that they had what they needed. Then they took all the items out of the room except my chair and the table and left me sitting there for a couple of hours. After, I was taken down to the holding cells. I got a single cell with an iron waffle bed, the kind they make drunk people sleep on until they sober up. I awoke to find a perfectly bald detective in a gray suit, standing on the other side of the bars. He didn't waste time with introductions. He just opened the doors and instructed me to follow him. There were no handcuffs this time, but I knew not to fuck around. Out back of the station, there was an armada of black SUVs. A massive black cop was driving the one I got into with the detective. They didn't say a word to each other, not hi, nothing. They didn't even nod to one another. The black fella scared the shit out of me. He looked like a Navy SEAL, but was dressed in what appeared to be a $1,000 suit and was wearing a black pair of sunglasses. His knuckles were scarred and he had cauliflower ears. I'd seen ears, scars, and knuckles like that before, on professional boxers and rugby players, but never on cops. I tried not to stare at him, but he caught me in the rearview mirror. He turned up the chatter crackling over their walkie-talkies. With sirens blaring on the lead car, our SUVs blew through a series of red lights, an ominous caravan of justice speeding mercilessly towards its destination. The morning sun didn't penetrate the tinted windows of our vehicle. It spilled in only briefly through the windshield as we turned and drove east a spell before we met another gang of trucks parked behind an abandoned warehouse. The detective in black eye told me to stay put and jumped out to meet a crew of bigger, even scarier men armed with guns. A few were dressed in black and gray camouflage commando gear, utility belts, and bulletproof vests covered in what looked like ammo magazines. I heard dogs barking in the back of one of their trucks. It was the Peel SWAT and canine units. They formed a half circle around the detective, who clapped his hands at every order he gave. The men jumped at his commands, checked their gear, then separated into groups of three and got in six different vehicles. "The shelter," the black guy said to the detective as he got into the driver's seat. "We're going to apprehend them there." The detective slapped the dashboard. I then saw that he had two handguns, one under his suit jacket under his arm in a holster, and one strapped to his leg. I could see the impression under his pants. He rubbed his hands over his bald head. "After we get them," he said to me, "we're going to take you up to the major crime unit on Courtney Park. We need more information from you." "I'll tell you whatever I know," I said, fearful of the power I knew he wielded. Outside the shelter, we saw four homeless men emerge near the smoking pit. The SUV circled round the building, reminding me of a well-coordinated pack of wolves stalking prey. The sound of truck tires on gravel was the only sound they made. The men in the smoking pit created more noise as they shivered and complained in the cold January dawn. I heard the black guy unclick the safety on his gun. He motioned to the lead detective, who ordered the others to wait until they had confirmation. The men in the SUV to our right, 50 meters away, were prepping their guns. They stood in position behind their doors, which were now splayed out for protection. There we waited and waited. 10 minutes went by, until over the radio I heard a voice that said, "Negative on the suspects. Staff says they didn't stay here last night. Stand down." The black cop clicked the safety back on his gun, and before I knew it, the pack of SUVs was driving off again. When we got to the major crime unit building, about a 30-minute drive from the shelter, I was placed in a room with plush couches and a TV that didn't work. They told me I had to stay there until they apprehended Mike and Stefan. I asked for a phone call, and they denied me. There I languished for 24 hours. It was the next evening when they finally came and got me. I'd stretched my shirt up around my head and tucked my arms in for warmth and was sleeping when the bald detective arrived. He seemed happy. "We got them at 3 p.m., Jess," he said. "They're at Olive's." I was relieved at the thought of them getting arrested, but I wasn't happy to hear they'd been at Olive's. I thought of Frank, Tim, and Olive and wondered where they had been when it happened. I hoped they weren't home. The cops never did ask me any more questions. They simply drove me home and told me I'd be okay because they'd protect my status as an informer. No more than 6 hours passed before I started hearing that I was a dead man walking. Aftermath. I was terrified that I was now in danger, a known informer. But curiosity overcame me. I decided to walk over to Olive's to see what had happened during Mike and Stefan's arrest. I couldn't get any closer than 200 meters because the area was blocked off by police tape. Buzzing about were forensic units, police vans, squad cars, sharply suited detectives, and uniformed police officers. There must have been around a dozen people. A few of my street friends stood transfixed, watching the commotion from a distance. They didn't notice me. The investigative team carried out box after box of evidence, and one had Tim's leather jacket in his hand. I imagined lines of determined ants hauling away leaves to their colony headquarters. Their industry was perfect, inhuman, insidious. I saw the shattered back window of the apartment, glass strewn all over Olive's porch and out onto the parking lot where, only 2 days earlier, Stan had warned me to be careful. The blue and red strobe of the squad car lights reflected off the shards, sending rays of broken color in every direction, dancing across my eyes, carving the scene into the back of my cranium. The police must have entered gangbusters that way. Olive, Frank, and Tim were nowhere in sight. I searched for Olive's cats and saw the bald detective arrive in his SUV. He ducked under the yellow tape and entered the apartment through the destroyed glass doors. He again seemed to be calling the shots, pointing his finger and making younger cops jump. I looked around for the big black cop, but he wasn't there. I walked closer and caught the attention of one of the neighborhood street kids who stood watching. "What's going on?" I asked, pretending like I knew nothing. A look of disgust shot across his face. "Don't chat to me," he said. "You'll get it soon enough, you fucking rat." He spit on the ground, mounted his bike, and flipped me the bird as he rode away. An old lady nearby said, "What a rude young man." I had broken a cardinal rule, the cardinal rule, omerta, silence above all else. Old friends I'd dealt drugs or gone to raves with wanted nothing to do with me. I was seen as untrustworthy, vile scum, the worst kind of person. People lured me to parties or to dark corners of the park with the promise of smoking a joint, then jumped me and beat me up. One tried to knife me in an alley. Another beat my leg with a baseball bat after he'd invited me to his place for a drink. The muscle on my thigh was clobbered so badly it was purple and black halfway up my belly, and it was nearly impossible for me to walk. I was lucky, though, that he never got to my knees, his original target. I surely would have been crippled. I bumped into a friend at the mall, who I used to sell sheets of acid with a few years before. "I'd have done the same thing," he said, when I saw him in front of the Chinese food stand. I was in between meals and he offered me a bowl of stew his mother cooked for lunch. He had it in a container in his knapsack. I ate it, but it tasted funny, bitter, sour, off or something. When I was done, he looked me right in the eye and said, "Eat shit and die, motherfucker." I was sick for a couple weeks afterwards. It was the worst retaliation of all, biological warfare, street style. The people who did talk to me only did so to give me attitude or tell me I wasn't worth the skin I was born in. All the maltreatment left me wondering if I'd done the right thing, if helping to deliver justice was worth it. I mean, maybe the cops wouldn't have found me with the shirt. Maybe Stefan and Mike would have gotten away with it. Maybe I should have just laid low until things cooled off. Maybe I should have just taken my chances. When I explained that to Uncle Ron, he assured me that I'd done the right thing. "It takes a lot of balls to do what you did, Jess. Don't doubt it." I was surprised. Jerry and Leroy, too, remained steadfast. Leroy got back from Vancouver right before the murder. "What the fuck, guy?" he said when he first saw me. "You just left me out there to die?" "I'm sorry." The logs floated by. There was light on the mountains. We were starving. I had to go. He crossed his arms like he wasn't convinced, but we still started hanging out. Things were different, though. We didn't share or trust the way we did before I had abandoned him. He wouldn't share dope with me as freely or booze, but he stuck by my side and defended me. Jerry and Leroy were spooked by the company I'd gotten myself involved with, though. Killers. But they stood with me, my brother and best friend, as everything collapsed around me. They never once told anyone where I was, even though I was sure people offered them rewards for my whereabouts. Around March, a couple of new detectives showed up at Uncle Ron's apartment. They said they were doing follow-up on the investigation. Apparently, they'd been searching for the knife I'd drawn, but had come up with nothing. It was a key piece of evidence. We even dredged the pond next to the complex where Mike and Stefan ran after they killed the cabbie, one detective said. We had a team of divers there for a month looking for it, but it wasn't there. The detective then told us that post-mortem examinations indicated that Baljinder Singh Ray had sustained massive stab wounds to the face and neck with a sharp object, most likely a knife 9 inches in length or longer, just like I'd drawn. that Ray evidently picked up two males who matched Stefan and Mike's description at the bus depot in downtown Brampton at 10 p.m. on December 31st. That he'd then driven them to Gateway 6 just behind the Pizza Hut, where he'd been attacked. They said Ray had held on just long enough to alert staff at the store before he bled to death. That turned my stomach. My heart hurt for his two children. I was raised without a father and knew that horrible pain well. But Stefan and Mike aren't saying a word, the detective said, and without the knife, we just can't be sure. His last comment lingered, like a poisonous gas that scorched my lungs, robbing me of breath. I'm fighting in the trenches on two fronts now, against the criminals and cops, I thought, because he'd implied the thing I feared most, the reason that they were in the apartment taking Uncle Ron and Jerry's statements. Why they'd begun canvassing people in my extended family, like Uncle Ralph, who was a Metro copper down at 52 Division. In Ralph's case, they'd asked him for my character profile and if I was capable of taking another man's life. In Uncle Ron's case, they'd asked for exact times of my movements on December 31st and if I acted strange the next night when we watched The Saint. Jerry never did tell me what they asked him. He avoided all my questions. It also began making sense that they'd held me for 24 hours after I'd reported the murder, and that I was denied a phone call the whole time I was in custody. The way they had collected my cigarette butts and coffee cups, one by one, during the initial questioning, also pointed to the fact that they'd been collecting my DNA. I realized I was still a suspect, and had been since the night of the murder. I was a suspect the police couldn't rule out because they'd failed to find the murder weapon. And Mike and Stefan wouldn't squeal on each other. Moreover, I was roughly the same size as Mike, and Leroy, amazingly, was the exact same height and weight as Stefan. It was well documented, too, that I had the shirt the crime was committed in. I wasn't sure if they ever considered Leroy a suspect, though. I wasn't even sure if it was all in my head, or if any of it was true. Maybe the pressure of everything was beginning to make me see things that weren't grounded in reality. Just show up in court and tell the judge what you know, the detective said before I left. I knew that the expression on my face betrayed me. My mind was fracturing. They're the ones charged, Jesse, he said, as if to comfort me. But a conviction is another matter altogether. We have to look at all possibilities. I held on to that sliver of hope for justice for 2 months until it was time for the preliminary hearing. But I questioned myself every day until then. I hid out at Uncle Ron's and drank and smoked crack until the paranoia forced me to hide under my brother's bed for hours at a time. I wouldn't even take the dog out for his bathroom breaks. My weight dropped and I was afraid to even put a garbage bag in the apartment building's chute, thinking it was the perfect spot for my enemies to ambush me and make me disappear, just like Dad. At the end of May, I was called to give evidence for the Crown at the old courthouse on Clarence Street, right in the heart of my old neighborhood. The courtroom was filled with many of Mike and Stefan's friends, some from around our hood, others I'd never seen before. No one I knew came, not Leroy, nor Jerry, nor Uncle Ron. I couldn't blame them. I could swear the people who were there mouthed, "You're dead," to me from the back benches. I tried to ignore them and sat up near the front, a few rows back from the Crown lawyer, where I knew I'd be safe if things went awry. Mike and Stefan entered the courtroom and glared at me from the bench behind the bailiff. I stared at them to show I wasn't scared, even though I was shitting bricks. Stefan leered right back. I couldn't turn away and let him win. When I took the stand, the Crown asked me to run through the details. He paused in between questions and let me think, getting me to note exactly how Stefan got the knife and how I'd helped him scam welfare. To me, the whole thing made sense. I'd been framed. Stefan and Mike were the framers. They were the murderers. I kept my head up after the crown finished with me. I sensed it was important to keep an air of confidence. I adjusted my shirt and tie and glanced over and saw that the judge had sketched out a few notes. A couple of words had red underlines. "Defense?" he said, his voice a slab of granite authority. "It's your turn." The judge peered over his glasses at me, and I held my back straight. I thought it might make him respect me more, but his head just swiveled, detached, unimpressed. He pushed his glasses up with his finger and continued on. I thought he might have secretly given me the middle finger, but the crown smiled at me as he took his seat. The defense, however, was having none of it. He walked up to the bench. It was hard to tell if he was angry or happy or what. His face was expressionless. He reminded me of an Old West gunslinger at high noon right before a showdown. Johnny fucking Law. He drew first, interrogating me on where I'd been on December 31st. I was frank. "I can't produce a witness as to where I was that night. I can barely remember where I was or who was at that party, but I didn't kill anybody." He again asked the same question 100 times over, just in different ways. I fiddled with my thumbs and thought of my grandma and the time she caught me stealing when I was young. Finally, I yelled, "And yes, I am a criminal. Have been since childhood. And yes, I do drugs, and these are the drugs I do." I proceeded to list over 100 different kinds of liquids, pills, powders, substances, herbs, plants, molds, and cacti. Every drug that I'd ever done since boyhood. I finished with, "But that doesn't make me someone whose word isn't good." The crown's face had gone ghost white. He was flabbergasted. Hell, I was flabbergasted. I just sunk my own testimony with my honesty. It was totally on the fly. I was an addict. A fucked up addict. I had to deal with it, end of story. The defense leaned over to the crown's desk and whispered loud enough for me to hear, "Solid witness you got there." He turned to Stefan and Mike and grinned. I didn't wait to see their reaction before I again peered over at the judge. "That's it, Mr. Thistle," he said. "You are relieved." His voice sounded like an ice shelf shearing off into the ocean. Kaboom! My legs wobbled as I slid out of the witness stand and bobbed toward the back doors. The onlookers were confused at what had just happened. Even Steph and Mike, the lawyers and the judge, had puzzled expressions on their faces. I'd simultaneously given the crown what it needed to go forward with a trial, while leaving the defense with enough ammunition to call my testimony into question. As I exited the courtroom, I was approached by an East Indian man around my age. "Hi, Jesse," he said. My adrenaline made it hard for me to focus. "My name is Paul Singh. We are in the same grade 10 class." It was difficult to tell, but I did recognize him as the quiet newcomer I'd gone to high school with, a boy who was unsure of his English back then. Paul had no accent at all now. "Yeah, I remember you," I said, still not fully aware of what I'd just done or if I'd get attacked outside. "Baljinder Ray was my uncle," his lip quivered. "I want to thank you for doing what you did, calling the police. I know it wasn't easy." His eyes teared up and he moved in for a hug. I opened my arms like a thistle in bloom, wrapping every leaf around him, thorns outward, keeping us both safe. "Don't mention it," I said. "I just did what I had to do." He invited me to a celebration of his uncle's life, but I declined. A few months later, the crown cut a deal with Mike. There was still no knife. Whatever happened, Mike McDonald pleaded guilty to manslaughter and got 10 years. Stefan Maselli pleaded guilty to second-degree murder and was sentenced to life without chance of parole for 13 years. Me? I got a lifetime of people thinking I was a rat. That I could live with, because I knew what really happened. They tried to make me their patsy, and I dealt with it. What other choice did I have as a young, native, homeless man? And I knew that the code of the streets was bullshit. Everyone cracks. No exceptions. I never found out if Frank had my back with a jersey, or even if it mattered. When I reconnected with him, I didn't have the heart to ask him about it. I didn't want to put him in the same position I was in.